thanks, Roberto. And just to follow up on that, I think the climate crisis and the financial crisis are very similar in the sense that both of them originated in the north. I mean, it's the developed countries that over the last 100 years emitted carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in order to allow for 4 or 5% economic growth, and Wall Street was in the north. And I think in both cases we see that the impacts are most forcibly felt in the south, both economically, financially, socially, but that there's huge issues of financial transfer, technological transfer that needs to happen in order to put in practice this concept of climate justice and paying off for that climate debt. Anyways, Richard.
Well, yeah, just to follow. I mean, just to follow on there and pick up Barry's point. I mean, I guess it's what Bertolt Brecht's famous phrase: "Thing because things are the way they are, things won't stay the way they are." which I guess is what you're saying, and I kind of agree with that. But it does require some sort of political process to kind of change it in the direction you want to see it go, and that does bring in this question of the role of the state, which I do think is incredibly important. I mean, there's that the old debate about the market. Somehow, the last 20 years have been about the rise of the market and the demise of the state. It's not one that I buy into. I mean, what happened in the last 20 years is essentially the state was. I mean, this is a kind of Jamie Galbraith argument. The state has been captured by a narrow set of interests, not just in developing countries, but far more significantly in developed countries as well. And in a sense, they're paying back right now for that capture. But until political forces somehow emerge that can begin to alter the political discussion and the way states interact with civil society, then there's a real danger that you won't get the kind of rebalancing that is required won't take place. And I would again go back to my point about the way in which the discussion in this country is going about warning now about what's going to happen in 10 years' time about a fiscal crisis. I mean, that's all about... And we saw that in Latin America, of course, in the early 80s. You know, it was this essentially part of the problem was that the state had to bail out financial and business interests in Latin America in the early 80s. It acquired a massive debt in the process of doing so, and it got caught up in a political and policy trap as a consequence of that he could never get out of, in a sense, for at least for a decade or more. So, I mean, you can see the same kind of thing happening in the advanced countries. And without some sort of political mobilization that can begin to shift that debate, that's clearly a possible future for advanced countries, and it won't be the direction of the New Deal. It won't be the direction the New Deal took in the 1930s. We are a forum. We're also a secretariat, Barry. You know, that is not, and it shouldn't. It should be an important part of the story. And we are technically an independent secretariat, and it should be our job to push forward independent ideas. I don't think we've done it in the way that we were set, we were meant to, but hopefully there are signs of a maybe when I've been taking some sort of semi-illegal substance, I probably think that there are signs of a recovery somewhere.
Thank you, Richard. You're asking some concluding remarks.
Concluding remarks. Just on the question of the role of the state and private sector and microfinance and so on. I mean, I think that some of this work that we do in terms of north-south transfers, in terms of aid and so on, some of that is no doubt beneficial. And microfinance, especially when it challenges gender roles, can be extremely, extremely important. And I don't want to belittle any of that. But that said, I mean, I think it really is the role of the state to choose a development model that will actually realize human rights. And here I go to, I wrote a paper about a year ago on sort of a contrasting Bangladesh's economic choices with those of Kerala. In Kerala is now known as kind of a development miracle and, you know, almost universal literacy and so on. But in the 1950s and 60s, that was not the case. That was really not the case. Kerala was another poor state in a poor country. And there was a series of decisions, starting with land reform, which were taken by the government, massive education policies, massive healthcare policies, massive infrastructure plans. And the result of that, I just visited Kerala for the first time about a year ago. Kerala looks like a first world country in the middle of a third world country. I mean, it really is. It was really, for me, as someone who spent a lot of time in India and part of my family's in India, it was really remarkable to see that. Bangladesh, which I've been to many times, is, you know, for all of the microfinance and for all of the, you know, small community success stories, is as disastrous a place as you can find on the earth. I mean, it really, there's not much going for it, especially if you look. It's bad enough, you know, I've had the opportunity of traveling in villages, and I speak the language, so I can hang out in Bangladesh and understand what's going on. That's bad enough, but when you look at the data, when you look at the numbers, you're like, oh my God, this really, I mean, okay, there's been some improvement, but because of the population growth and so on, that improvement it amounts to zero. So I think we have to learn lessons from states that actually have done well. Maybe Botswana in Africa is another example of a state that has actually, you know, taken a different path and actually achieved some of these goals, as opposed to, you know, I hate to pick on countries, but, you know, Ghana or Tanzania, I mean, some of the countries that have really been picked over by the structural adjustment policies and whose economies have really been told, this is the way you're meant to function. And for all the microfinance, for whatever you want to pour into Ghana or Tanzania, you're still going to have massive poverty, you're still going to have massive inequality. So I think it really is, and when we talk about the role of the state, we're talking about the role of us, the role of the people, the role of democracies, and the extent to which we can control our own states and get them to do what we think they should do in terms of building up a middle class in their own country, or what we think they should do in the United Nations. That's the extent to which we're going to recognize some of the promises that I think many of the authors of this report share. That was my attempt at a wrap.
Thank you. I think we leave it at that, because some of us have to run to another meeting, unfortunately, on a similar topic.
Should we announce the other meeting?
Sorry?
Should we announce the other meeting?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't actually remember where it takes place. Is that an open meeting? Or?
I think everyone would be welcome.
Okay, yes. So it's a meeting.
Yeah, we were told to encourage people to go.
It's a meeting
after have a coffee, of course.
Co-organized by Amnesty International and Realizing Rights, the Ethical Globalization Initiative, which is the organization headed by Mary Robinson, and it's taking place at the Aspen Institute, which is on 271 Madison Avenue on the 6th floor. So I believe that's at the corner of
3rd and 40th.
Between
39 and 40th.
Between 39th and 40th Street. So I repeat, it's the Aspen Institute, 271 Madison Avenue on the 6th floor, and it's starting in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you very much to all of you for participating, and thank you to all three of our panelists for sharing information, knowledge, and experiences. Thank you.
I think I sent you also something else for postage.